The next subheading of this chapter is Nature and Functions of a Poet, the Nature of Poetic Sensibility, Qualifications of a Poet. So the first point is Qualifications of a Poet, and in this the first major subheading is The Gift of Communication. Wordsworth's view of the nature and function of a poet is an exalted one. He brings out the individualism of the poet, but at the same time, at every step, he takes care to stress his essential humanity. In the very beginning, he lays emphasis on his social function, that is, that of communication. First, a poet for him is essentially a man speaking to man. He is a person who writes not for his own pleasure, but primarily to communicate his own thoughts and emotions to his readers. He has thus a social function to perform. As poets do not write for poets alone, but for the man, they must use the language of real man and not talk in tricks, quaintances, hieroglyphics, and enigmas. He must come down from his supposed heights. Commenting on Wordsworth's emphasis on the common humanity of the poet, Gerould writes that the office of the poet is a propesi, that he belongs to an order of men who are rapt, possessed, uttering more than they know. Wordsworth was well aware, as other poets who have brought into greater display that element of poetry which consists in ecstasy, he is quite conscious of the individualism of the poet, that the poet is a rare and gifted individual, a man of genius, a unique personality in many ways. But in the preface, he is primarily concerned, and rightly so, with emphasizing the connection between what is greatest in human nature and what is the most lowly. In this way, he seeks to make the poet come out of his ivory tower. In this way, he seeks to democratize the conception of the poet. Then point B is heightened sensibility. Secondly, he is a man who has more lively sensibility. That is to say, he reacts more strongly to external impressions, and so his emotions and passions are more powerful. He has an uncommon sensibility, and this again distinguishes him from the common run of mankind. He observes more than there is to observe, hears more than there is to hear, and feels more than there is to feel. Not only has he a more lively sensibility, he has also a more affectioned sensibility, and it is in this affectioned sensibility that poetry begins. His sensibility is effectual, that is, it is bound up with our moral nature. It is because of this effectual element in the poet's sensibility that the sense impressions he receives and the passions they excite are gradually purified by the imagination, and poetry performs its true function. Then point C, power of imagination, knowledge, and gist for life. Gest for life, G-E-S-T. Thirdly, he has greater imagination and so can feel or react emotionally to events and incidents which he has not directly experienced. He is affected by absent things and as if they were present. Fourthly, he has greater knowledge of human nature, and so understands the nature of passions which he has not himself experienced directly. He understands accurately the nature of human passions and emotions, even of those which he has not personally experienced. Fifthly, he has a more comprehensive shawl. A more comprehensive shawl implies that the poet shares the emotional experience of others, can identify himself emotionally with others, and can express the feelings and emotions of others. Sixthly, he has a greater zest for human life than an ordinary individual. He has greater enthusiasm. He rejoices in the working of life in others and in nature at large, and takes pleasure in communicating his own joy in life to others. Then point F, reflection. A poet not only has a more lively sensibility, a more comprehensive shawl, and greater powers of imagination, he is also a man who has thought long and deep. He doesn't create on the spur of the moment, but contemplates and reflects in tranquility till he passions anew, and it is then that creation begins. This process of reflection purifies the sensations of the poet of all that is painful and distressing, and therefore what he creates carries with it joy and overbalance of pleasure. It is through this reflection or contemplation that the poet is able to combine one idea with another, and in this way to discover universal and general laws of our being. It is through thought that he universalizes personal experience. Then point G, sincerity. Later on, Wordsworth added one more quality for the poet, that of sincerity. The sincerity of the poet is seen in the care which he takes to revise and perfect his communication. He is careful to polish and refine his composition and takes infinite pains to convey his meaning clearly and unambiguously. It is with this end in view that he avoids all that is artificial and pedantic in language. The poet, no doubt, has a heightened power of communication, but even then the language which he uses is not so lively and true as the language of men who have actually experienced those passions. The poet writes of emotions which he himself has not experienced, but which his characters have experienced, and so the passions which he communicates are mere shadows of passions of real men. So, the language used by him is likely to be mechanical, lacking in warmth and liveliness of the language used by men in real life. Therefore, the poet should try to achieve emotional identification with the characters whose feelings he has to convey, and he should do so in a language which such characters do actually use in real life. This language should be modified only by one consideration, that of giving pleasure. The function of poetry is to give pleasure, and with this end in view, the poet should apply the principle of selection and purify his language of all that is coarse, vulgar, painful, and disgusting. However, it may be pointed out here that by pleasure, Wordsworth does not mean mere ideal amusement. His conception of pleasure is a much higher one. There is no need at all for the poet to elevate his language. No language is nobler and more elevated than the one which is really used by men and which the poet truthfully and faithfully imitates. Then, conclusion. In short, Wordsworth considers a poet essentially a man speaking to men. Yet, says Garrod, if he will allow no difference of kind between poets and men, it must be conceded he makes as wide as he can the difference of degree. He has sufficiently stressed the individuality of the poet. Then point I. Wordsworth's view on meter, the function of meter, reasons of Wordsworth's defense of it, the weakness of his defense. Then taking the first point, Wordsworth's defense of meter, its weakness. The preface to the Lyrical Ballads, says Garrod, is quite as much a defense of employment of meter in poetry as a protest against the use of poetic diction. Wordsworth does not consider meter as essential to poetry. He regards it as merely pleasure superadded, but all the same he allows its use while he rejects the use of poetic diction. He rejects poetic diction because it is artificial, capricious, and lawless, and he allows the use of meter for meter obeys definite laws, and its use is sanctified by tradition and authority. This defense of meter is the weakest part of the preface. It has rightly been pointed out that if poetic diction is artificial, meter is equally artificial and should be rejected for the same reasons. His view that meter has been used since times immemorial and that its rules are fixed, while the use of poetic diction is capricious and arbitrary, is not justified by literary history. Other subheading, reasons for the defense. Wordsworth himself was conscious of the contradiction inherent in his attitude. Therefore, later in the preface, he gives a more elaborate defense of meter. He points out that he himself has written in verse and not in prose, because in his poems he has written of universal passions of men, of their most interesting occupations, and of the world of nature. He could have very well written of these subjects in prose, but he has preferred to write in verse, firstly, because the use of meter is an additional source of pleasure. I repeat the line, because the use of meter is an additional source of pleasure. It is pleasure superadded. Secondly, in support of his defense of meter, Wordsworth appeals to authority and tradition. He points out that people in all ages and countries have acknowledged the charm of metrical language, and in this respect he had simply followed tradition. Thirdly, it would not be correct to say that only a very small part of the poetic pleasure depends on meter, and that meter must be accompanied with an appropriate poetic diction if it is to impart full satisfaction. Such views underrate the power of meter to give pleasure. That meter in itself is a source of great pleasure is borne out by the fact that there are poems on more humbler subjects and more naked and simple in language than the poet's own compositions, which have continued to give pleasure from generation to generation. Therefore, the poet is justified in using meter and rejecting poetic diction. Then fourthly, the end of poetry is to produce emotional excitement, and excitement is an unusual state of mind. In a state of excitement, ideas and feelings do not follow each other in the accustomed order. Sometimes emotional excitement may be too excessive, and some kind of restraint may become necessary. Meter has this restraining and tempering effect. Fifthly, meter is something regular, and as the mind is accustomed to it, its use introduces an element of the regular and the usual, which restrains and softens unusual mental states. The use of meter is indispensable when the more pathetic and painful situations have to be rendered. Meter has a distancing effect. It divests the language of its reality and imparts to the description an unsubstantial, dreamlike quality. Hence, the painful seems remote and so becomes more endurable. This view is borne out by many an old ballad and by the most pathetic scenes in Shakespeare. Sixthly, the use of meter intermingles an element of pleasure with the painful and so softens and mitigates it. Seventhly, the use of meter imparts passion to the words and thus enables the poet to produce the necessary emotional excitement. The use of meter is desirable for some other reasons also. It is a general principle that the human mind receives pleasure from a perception of similarity in dissimilarity or dissimilarity in similarity. It is this principle which is the basis of our pleasure in sex, and it is for this very reason that we derive pleasure from simile and metaphor. It is this very principle which accounts for the pleasure of meter, for the use of meter provides this element of contrast. Meter is regular, while a poem has a number of other varied elements. However, we may point out that Wordsworth doesn't develop this point in detail, perhaps for reasons of space. The point was later elaborated by Coleridge in his Biographia Literaria. Further, Wordsworth justifies the use of meter by referring to the process of poetic creation. We get his famous definition of poetry as a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, and that it has its origin in emotions recollected in tranquility. The earlier emotions are recollected and revived in moments of tranquility, but they are now purged of much that was accidental, temporary, and disgusting. Thus, the particular emotion is universalized. Such is the process of poetic creation, and it gives joy to the poet. When he communicates, he wants to convey his own joy to his readers, and meter helps him in this respect. The pathetic and painful emotions are tempered by the use of meter, and the lighter emotions acquire an added ease and gracefulness. The use of meter gives the readers a sense of the skill of the poet in overcoming artistic difficulties, and this in itself gives pleasure. Further, meter makes even ordinary commonplace language of real life look different and unusual, and the contrast produces a feeling of delight. It is for all these reasons that most people prefer words to prose. Then point J. Poetry, philosophy, history and science. A comparative study. Nature of poetic truth, poetic pleasure. In this, the first subheading is exalted conception of poetry. Wordsworth's conception of poetry is an exalted and noble one. He is in full agreement with Aristotle that poetic truth is much higher than the truth of history or philosophy. In his view, as in that of Greek philosopher, poetry is more philosophical than philosophy itself. It is the most philosophical of all writings. By the word philosophical, he means more conducive to understanding, a better source of knowledge and wisdom. While history deals merely with particular facts and gives examples to illustrate those facts, and philosophy deals merely with abstract and universal truths without providing any illustrations of those truths, poetry alone deals with both, with the particular and the general. It aims at universal truths and also illustrates them through particular examples. The other subheading, poetic pleasure, its nature, its sources. Poetry is the image of man and nature. It aims at truth to nature, at the faithful reproduction of reality. This faithful adherence to nature and reality is modified only by one consideration, that of giving pleasure. This is the only obstacle between the poet and the truth he aims at. While there are 1,000 obstacles in the way of the historian and the philosopher, Wordsworth doesn't specify what these obstacles are, but they can readily be guessed. For example, the historian must collect his facts painstakingly, painstakingly. I repeat the line. For example, the historian must collect his facts painstakingly from old documents before he can interpret them correctly. The fact that the function of poetry is to give immediate pleasure must not be regarded as degradation of the poet's art. On the contrary, it is an acknowledgement of the beauty of the universe and of the worth and dignity of man. This function can be performed only by one who looks at the world with love. Pleasure is the basic principle of life and nature. It is through pleasure that man knows, feels, lives, and moves. We sympathize only because sympathy gives pleasure. Sympathy with those in pain and suffering causes inner satisfaction. Knowledge of reality, of essential truths, can be acquired only through sympathy. It is only when our soul is in sympathy with the soul of nature that we see into the heart of things. Then the other subheading, poetic truth. Knowledge of truth is a source of spiritual pleasure. The scientists, the mathematicians, and others work hard to acquire knowledge only because knowledge gives pleasure. Knowledge even of the painful and the disgusting is a source of pleasure. The students are here reminded of Aristotle's dictum that imitation even of the ugly and obnoxious, when well done, is a source of pleasure. Imitation of the unknown and the unfamiliar gives pleasure because it increases our knowledge. The poet studies the elemental nature of man in his elementary instincts and impulses. He studies man in his ordinary life. He studies the actions and reactions of man and nature, through which man acquires a host of ideas and sensations, convictions and deductions. This knowledge he acquires through his sympathy with the objects of nature, and it always results in an overbalance, that is, surplus or remainder of pleasure. The poet perceives the organic unity between man and nature. He is conscious of the sympathy that exists between man and the objects and phenomena of nature, and this awareness gives him pleasure. The soul of man as well as the soul of the nature is derived from God, and hence results the essential oneness of man and nature. It is for this reason that he considers the mind of man as a mirror to the beauty of nature. The realization of this universal truth gives him pleasure. The scientist also works hard over long periods of time in search for truth. He also finds pleasure in the discovery of truth, but the truth which he realizes is particular and personal. It is realized through study and research in a particular field, and it cannot be shared by mankind in general. Its truths and its pleasure is limited only to the individual scientist. Poetic truth and poetic pleasure, on the other hand, can be shared by all because it results from the perception of the basic principles of life, that is, the fact of unity of nature and man and all other forms of life. Then, the other subheading is Poetry and Science. Poetry, in this respect, is far superior to science. In his view, the knowledge provided by science is superficial and entirely intellectual. The scientist studies only through the intellect. He murders to dissect, and he studies only the appearance of things. The poet, on the other hand, goes down to the inner reality. He peers surface appearances and reaches the soul that lies beneath. And because he is a man of greater sensibility, the truth which he discovers is charged with his feelings and emotions. That is why Wordsworth defines poetry as the breadth and finer spirit of all knowledge. It is the impassioned expression which is in the countenance of all science. The truth of the poet can be shared by all because it is the realization of basic laws which have always been the same in all ages and countries. He sings a song in which all can join and which can please all. A poet, therefore, is a general benefactor, a genial friend and companion. The scientist also is a benefactor, but he remains aloof, enjoying his knowledge of truth in solitude. It is the message of love and unity that the poet brings, and he seeks to bind all mankind in ties of mutual love and affection. Nature everywhere speaks to him of the essential oneness of all. The perception of this truth excites him emotionally, and he expresses his own emotions and sensations in the poems he writes. Therefore, his appeal is not merely to the intellect, but also to the heart of man. Poetry is the first and last of all knowledge. It is an immortal as the heart of man. A time may come when science will revolutionize the material conditions of human life. At that time also, poetry will play a useful role. Then the poet will enjoy the achievements of science with feeling and emotion, and thus will present them to his readers in an emotional and vivid form. The poet will thus always complete and impart perfection to the truths discovered by the scientist. It is he who will impart life and substance, flesh and blood, to the dry bones of science. Then point K. The function of poetry. Poet as teacher. Poetry as the breath and final spirit of all knowledge. Then function of poetry, its teaching. Wordsworth had an exalted conception of his own calling. In the preface, he calls poetry the most philosophical of all writings, the breadth and final spirit of all knowledge, the impassioned expression that is the countenance of all science, the image of man and nature, etc. In one of his letters, he writes, "Every great poet is a teacher. I wish either to be considered as a teacher or as nothing." In one of the celebrated passages of Excursion, he writes that poetry has its value and significance in framing models to improve the scheme of man's existence and recast the world. Then the other subheading is pleasure. Wordsworth tells us that the function of poetry is to produce excitement in coexistence with an overbalance of pleasure. In his emphasis on pleasure as the primary aim of poetry, Wordsworth differs from the neoclassics, who considered that the aim of poetry was to instruct and delight. Thus, the proper function of poetry is to give pleasure. But Wordsworth's conception of pleasure is not purely aesthetic one. His conception of pleasure is moral. Poetry doesn't merely provide momentary pleasure, merely such ideal amusement as is provided by drinking sherry or rope dancing. Poetry does provide such momentary pleasure, and it is provided by the use of meter, rhyme, and such other external aids which temper and soften even the painful emotions. But such pleasure is not the real aim of poetry. Poetry aims at a pleasure which is much higher, the pleasure which results from the realization of truth. It is the pleasure which results from inner enlightenment and from the strengthening and purification of emotions which poetry aims at. Poetry makes the readers saner and purer than before. Saner, S-A-N-E-R. All good poetry, Wordsworth tells us, is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, and the poems to which any value can be attached were never produced on any variety of subjects but by a man who, being possessed of more than usual organic sensibility, and also thought long and deeply. For our continued influxes, the feelings are modified and directed by our thoughts, which are indeed the representatives of all our past feelings. With the habit thus formed, our feelings will be connected with important and permanent objects of nature. In this way are discovered the general and universal laws of human life and nature, which, when rendered in poetry, enlighten the understanding and purify the emotions. Then the next heading is poetry, a source of consolation and strength. Wordsworth hoped that his poems would operate to extend the domination and sensibility for the delight, honor, and benefit of human nature. He trusted that it was their destiny to console the afflicted, to add sunshine to daylight by making the happy happier, to lead the young and the gracious of every age to see, to think, and to feel, and therefore to become more actively and securely virtuous. A poet looks before and after. He is the rock of defense for human nature, an upholder and preserver of man, carrying everywhere with him relationship and love. The poet performs this function by discovering universal laws of human nature and communicating them to his readers. In spite of differences of climate, of language and manners, of laws and customs, the poet binds together by passion and knowledge the vast empire of human society as it is spread over the whole earth and over all time. Then the next subheading is knowledge and truth. Poetry is the first and last of all knowledge. It is as immortal as the heart of man. Wordsworth emphasized the fact that if the labors of man of science should ever create any material revolution, poetry will then act as the complement of science. If the time should ever come when science, familiarized to man, shall be ready to put on, as it were, a form of flesh and blood, the poet will lend his divine spirit to add the transfiguration. Wordsworth states that the human mind is capable of being excited without the application of gross and violent stimulants, and that one being is elevated above the another in proportion as he possesses this capability, and that in his view to endeavor to produce or enlarge this capability is one of the best services in which a poet can be engaged. Poetry should purify the taste of the public and awaken their sensibility. Wordsworth had an invincible faith that his poetry discovered the truth of nature in some new way and that it was bound to make an audience for himself by reason of widened sensibility. Its fresh discovery of the truth of nature and the new pleasure it gave. To discover something fresh and original in the manifold beauty of nature and in the mind of man, and to teach or communicate this truth to his readers, that he thought was the mission of poetry. Poetry gives pleasure because, like science, it also pursues truth, and truth, when discovered and communicated, is always pleasurable. It increases our knowledge of human life and human nature, and so makes us wiser and also nobler and better. Its truths are discovered not through the meddling intellect, but through imagination and intuition, intuition, and so its truths are universal and general, while the truths of science are merely personal and particular. The truths of science can be enjoyed only by scientists, while the truths of poetry are a common heritage of all, and so a source of pleasure to all its readers. The next subheading is poetry a force for good. It is for all these reasons that poetry is an immense force for good. Wordsworth's own subject in writing poetry was to console the afflicted, to add sunshine to daylight by making the happy happier, to teach the young and the gracious of every age to see, to think and feel, and therefore to become more actively and securely virtuous. So in his view, every great poet is a teacher. I wish either to be considered as a teacher or as nothing. This is also what Plato, with whom Wordsworth has much in common, wanted poetry to do, but as the latter everywhere insists on pleasure as being a necessary condition of poetic teaching, he may be said to follow Horace more than Plato. Wordsworth, in a famous passage in a letter concerning his own poems, seem to echo the very sentiments of Plato. They will cooperate with the benign tendencies in human nature and society, and will, in their degree, be efficacious in making men wiser, better, and happier. In the preface, these benign tendencies are defined as relationship and love, which it is the great function of poetry to promote. But this is to be done through a purgation of feelings rather than through a mere appeal to the intellect or good sense. Then conclusion. In this way, his teaching is different from the instruction of the classics. In this way, does he reconcile pleasure and instruction and fuse them into a whole. Then point L. Wordsworth on imagination, comparison with Coleridge. Imagination, a creative power. In order to understand Wordsworth's view on imagination, we have to go to his poems and to his letter. In the preface, the word occurs first when Wordsworth tells us that his purpose has been to select incidents and situations from humble and common life and make them look uncommon and unusual by throwing over them a coloring of imagination. This makes it clear that imagination is a transforming and transfiguring power which present the usual in an unusual light. The poet does not merely present an image of man and nature, but he also shapes, modifies, and transfigures that image by the power of his imagination. Thus, imagination is creative. It is a shaping or plastic power. The poet is half the creator. He is not a mere mechanical reproducer of outward reality, but a specially gifted individual who, like God, is a creator or maker as he adds something to nature and reality. It is the imagination of the poet which imparts to nature the glory and freshness of a dream, the light that never was on land and sea. It should be noted that in making the poet's imagination a creative power, Wordsworth goes counter to the associationist theories of David Hartley, who had in other respect considerable influence on the poet. Hartley and other associationist psychologists had thought that the human mind receives impressions from the external world, which are therein associated together to form images. In this way, the mind merely reflects the external world. But according to Wordsworth, the mind does not merely reflect passively, it actively creates. At least, it is half the creator. Imagination is the active creative faculty of the mind. As Florence Marsh points out, for Wordsworth, imagination is a mental power which alters the external world creatively. It is a world of higher import, denoting operations of the human mind upon those objects and processes of creation or composition governed by certain fixed laws. It is through imagination that the poet realizes his kinship with the eternal. Imagination works upon the raw material of sense impressions to illustrate the working of external truths. It is this power which makes the poet perceive the essential unity of man, God, and nature, while the meddling intellect of the scientist multiplies diversities. Then the next subheading, a visualizing power. Again, he tells us that the poet is a man who has thought long and deeply, and so he can treat of things which are absent as if they were present. In other words, the poet contemplates in tranquility the emotions which he had experienced in the past and can visualize the objects which gave rise to those emotions initially. Thus, imagination becomes a visualizing power which enables the poet to recreate the past. Imagination is the mind's eye through which the poet sees into the heart of things, as well as into the past, the remote, and the unknown. It is imagination which enables the poet to render emotional experiences which he has not personally experienced, as if they were personally felt emotions. The next subheading is a universalizing power. It is this power of imagination which enables the poet to universalize the particular and the personal. It is through this power that the poet arrives at universal truths. Henry Crabbe Robinson described the process in the following words. The poet first conceives the essential nature of his object and then strips it of all casualties and accidental individual dress, and in this he is a philosopher. But to exhibit this abstraction nakedly would be the work of a mere philosopher. Therefore, he reclothes his ideas in an individual dress which expresses the essential quality and has also the spirit and life of a sensual object. And this transmutes the philosophic into a poetic exhibition. The next subheading is Imagination and Poetic Creation, Insight. Stressing the importance which Wordsworth attached to the role of imagination in the process of poetic creation, C.M. Bora writes, "For him, the imagination was the most important gift that a poet can have, and his arrangement of his own poems shows what he meant by it. The section which he calls Poems of Imagination contains poems in which he united creative power and a special visionary insight. He agreed with Coleridge that this activity resembles that of God. It is the divine capacity of the child who fashions his own little world." Then under this we have some lines from poem. "For feeling has to him imparted power that through the growing faculties of sense doth like an agent of the one great mind create creator and receiver both, working but in alliance with the works which it beholds." The poet keeps this faculty even in his maturity, and through it he is what he is. But Wordsworth was fully aware that mere creation is not enough, that it must be accompanied by a special insight. So he explains that the imagination, and he says like, is but another name for absolute power, but clearest insight, amplitude of mind, and reason in her most exalted mood. Wordsworth did not go so far as the other romantics in relating reason to an inferior position. He preferred to give a new dignity to the word and to insist that inspired insight is itself rational. It should be noticed that here Wordsworth calls imagination reason in her most exalted mood. It is a higher reason than mere reason. It is that faculty which transforms sense, perceptions, and makes the poet conscious of human immortality. It makes him have visions of the divine. Then the next subheading, fancy and imagination, comparison with Coleridge. Wordsworth deals with imagination at much greater length in his preface to the 1815 edition of the Lyrical Ballads. There he draws a distinction between fancy and imagination. Wordsworth's distinction between fancy and imagination is not so subtle and penetrating as that of Coleridge. According to Wordsworth, both imagination and fancy evoke and combine, aggregate and associate. But the material which they evoke and combine is different, and their purpose in evoking and combining is different. They differ not in their natures but in their purpose and in the material on which they work. The material on which fancy works is not so susceptible to change or so pliant as the material on which imagination works. Fancy makes things exact and definite, while imagination leaves everything vague and indefinite. Then Ren Valleck's comment in this respect is illuminating and interesting. Both Wordsworth and Coleridge make the distinction between fancy, a faculty which handles fixities and definities, and imagination, a faculty which deals with the plastic, the pliant, and the indefinite. The only important difference between Wordsworth and Coleridge is that Wordsworth does not clearly see Coleridge's distinction between imagination as a holistic, that is, a power which makes wholes, and fancy as an associative power, and does not draw the sharp distinction between transcendentalism and associationism, which Coleridge wanted to establish. Then point M and the next subheading, an estimate of Wordsworth as a critic, his merits and demerits, his greatness as a critic, his achievement. A inspired critic. Wordsworth was primarily a poet and not a critic. He has left behind him no comprehensive treatise on criticism. The bulk of his literary criticism is small. Though the bulk of Wordsworth's criticism is small, the core of his literary criticism is as inspired as his poetry. This is the statement of J.A. Champman. There is the same utter sincerity, earnestness, passion, and truth in both. He knew about poetry in the real sense of the word, and he has not said even a single word about poetry, said Champman, which is not valuable and worth thinking over. Then the other subheading is Herald of the Romantic Movement. Wordsworth's criticism is of far-reaching historical significance. When Wordsworth took to writing, it was the neoclassical criticism which held the days. Critics were preoccupied with poetic genres. Poetry was judged on the basis of rules devised by Aristotle and other ancients and interpreted by the Italian and French critics. They cared for rules, for methods, for outward form, and had nothing to say about the substance, the soul of poetry. Wordsworth is the first critic to turn from the form of poetry to its substance. He is the first critic who builds a theory of poetry and gives an account of the nature of the creative process. He is the first in many fields. His emphasis is on novelty, experiment, liberty, spontaneity, inspiration, and imagination, as contrasted with the classical emphasis on authority, tradition, and restraint. His preface is an unofficial manifesto of English Romantic movement. He is a great literary landmark which gave a new direction, consciousness, and program to English Romanticism. After Wordsworth had written, literary criticism could never be same as before. Then the other subheading, Rejection of the Old. Wordsworth, through his literary criticism, demolishes the old and the faculty and opens out new vistas and new avenues. He discards the artificial and restricted forms of approved 18th century poetry. Disgusted by the gaudiness and inane phraseology of many modern writers, he castigates poets who separate themselves from the sympathies of men and indulge in arbitrary and capricious habits of expression in order to furnish food for fickle tastes and fickle appetites of their own creation. Discarding formal finish and perfection, he stresses vivid sensation and spontaneous feeling. He says, all good poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. He discards Aristotelian doctrine. For him, the plot or situation is not the first thing. It is the feeling that matters. Then the other subheading is Stress on Simplicity. Reacting against the artificiality of 18th century poetry, he advocates simplicity both in theme and treatment. He advocates a deliberate choice of subjects from humble and rustic life. Instead of being preoccupied with nymphs and goddesses, he portrays the emotions of village girls and peasants. There is a healthy realism in his demand that the poet should use the language of common men, the language of prose when prose is well written, and that he should aim at keeping the reader in the company of flesh and blood. There is no doubt in themselves, his views in this respect are open to criticism. As Scott James points out, the flesh and blood of a rustic is not more human than the flesh and blood of a townsman, and his emotions are not more profound. Besides, by confining himself exclusively to rustic life, he excluded many essential elements in human experience. In this way, he narrowed down his range. His insistence on the use of selection of language really used by men is always in danger of becoming trivial and mean. There is also no doubt that he is guilty of overemphasis every now and then, and that it is easy to pick holes in his theories. Coleridge could easily demolish his theory of poetic diction and demonstrate that a selection of language as advocated by Wordsworth would differ in no way from the language of any other man of common sense. Then his historical significance. All the same, the historical significance of his criticism is very great. It served as a corrective to the artificial and inane phraseology of contemporary poetry and emphasized the value of a simpler and more natural language. By advocating simplicity in theme, he succeeded in enlarging the range of English poetry. He attacked what was old, outdated, and trivial, and created a taste for the new and the significant. He emphasized the true nature of poetry as an expression of emotion and passion, and so dealt a death blow to the dry intellectuality of contemporary poetry. In this way, he brought about a revolution in the theory of poetry and made popular acceptance of the new poetry, the romantic poetry, possible. Then another subheading, his achievement. Wordsworth is the first English critic to consider at length the nature of poetry and the creative process. He is a great pioneer in this field. Wordsworth is a romantic in his emphasis on spontaneity, imagination, intuition, and inspiration. Intuition, INTUITION. I repeat the line. Wordsworth is a romantic in his emphasis on spontaneity, imagination, intuition, and inspiration. But unlike the other romantics, he also lays a stress on the element of thought in poetry. He has a high conception of his own calling, and so knows that great poetry cannot be produced by a careless or thoughtless person. Poems to which any value can be attached, he says, were never produced on any variety of subjects but by a man who, being possessed of more than usual organic sensibility, had also thought long and deeply. Poetic process is a complex one. Great poetry is not produced on the spur of the moment. It is produced only when the original emotion is contemplated in tranquility and the poet passions anew. Wordsworth goes against the neoclassic view that poetry should both instruct and delight, when he stresses that the function of poetry is to give pleasure, a pleasure of a noble and exalted kind, pleasure which results from increased understanding and sympathy. If at all it teaches, it does so only indirectly, by purifying the emotions, uplifting the soul, and bringing it nearer to nature. The credit for having democratized the conception of the poet must go to the Wordsworth. According to Wordsworth, the poet is essentially a man who differs from other men not in kind but only in degree. He is essentially a man speaking to man. He has certain gifts in a higher degree than others. He has a more lively sensibility, a more comprehensive soul, greater powers of observation, imagination, and communication. He is also a man who has thought long and deep. Others also have these gifts, but the poet has them in higher degree. Wordsworth emphasizes his organic oneness as also the need for him of emotional identification with other men. It will not do for him to sit high and alone in his ivory tower. He must come out into the light of common day, share in the joys and sorrow of common men and women, and write for their pleasure. And at last we come to the conclusion. We can do no better than conclude this account of the achievement of Wordsworth as a critic with the words of Ren Wellek. Wordsworth thus holds a position in the history of criticism which must be called ambiguous or transitional. He inherited from neoclassicism a theory of imitation of nature to which he gives, however, a specific social twist. He inherited from the 18th century a view of poetry as passion and emotion, which he again modified by his description of the poetic process as recollection in tranquility. He takes up theoretical ideas about the effect of poetry, but extends and amplifies them into a theory of the social effects of literature, binding society in a spirit of love. But he also adopts, in order to meet the exigencies of his mystical experiences, a theory of poetry in which imagination holds the central place as a power of unification and ultimate insight into the unity of the world. Though Wordsworth left only a small body of criticism, it is rich in survivals, suggestions, anticipations, and personal insights. And thus we come to the end of this chapter, that is Romantic Criticism of William Wordsworth.